District Court of Appeals. We have five cases to be submitted today on oral argument. At least tentatively, we'll probably take a break after the third case, but we may decide to take an additional break before completing the docket. And we begin with United States versus Daniels. Ms. Gore.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. Kimberly Gore on behalf of the Office of the Federal Public Defender and Leilani Tynes at council table to represent Mr. Daniels in this matter. The issue before this court is whether 18 U.S.C. Section 922 G3 is violative of the Second Amendment. To paraphrase another court that has faced this issue, the question here is thus, whether stripping someone of their right to possess a firearm solely because they use marijuana is consistent with the nation's historical tradition of firearm regulation. If it is not, then Section 922 G3 cannot be constitutionally applied to Mr. Daniels, no matter the reasonableness of the policy that it embodies. Under the historical tradition test set forth in Bruin, Your Honors, the answer is no. Section 922 G3 is not constitutional. Bruin and Rahimi have resolved the first part of the test, whether Mr. Daniels' conduct, possession of a firearm, is covered by the plain text of the Second Amendment. It certainly is. And Mr. Daniels is certainly one of the people presumptively entitled to protection under the Second Amendment. But the government cannot meet its burden under the second part of the Bruin test to demonstrate that Section 922 G3 is consistent with the nation's historical tradition of firearm regulation.
You would agree that I assume that there's a history and tradition of regulation by those who are intoxicated?
Your Honor, there is, but it's a quite limited restriction on firearm possession and firearm use. And the Bruin test tells us that we need to look at how and why the statute at issue regulates the right to possess a firearm.
So why do you suppose they would have prohibited use of firearms by those who were intoxicated? Well, what would have been the reason for that?
Well, Your Honor, the government bears the burden of proof, and they've presented three colonial era statutes that existed at the time of the founding or existed around the time of the founding that they say would meet that test. But when you look at the underlying purpose of those statutes, they don't necessarily address the same issue that the Gun Control Act was intended to do. For example, the Virginia statute from 1655 prevents shooting guns at drinking, but it makes exceptions for weddings and funerals. And if you look at the purpose of that statute as it existed at the time, it was to keep noise down. At that time, settlers and colonists faced a risk of attacks by tribal people in the area, indigenous people, and the noise from the guns prevented them from raising alarms in the event of an attack. I'd also look at how that statute burdened the Second Amendment right. People were only prohibited from using that firearm, not possessing it, but using it while they were actively intoxicated.
In Bruin, did they look at penalty in the how part, or was it just whether there's a restriction?
Bruin's a little bit different, Your Honor, because it addresses a regulatory framework. It was a shall issue type of statute as opposed to this statute, which is a criminal statute. But we do have some examples of criminal statutes that attempted to regulate actively intoxicated people and prevent them from using firearms.
All the statutes, the colonial, the three, are relate to shooting, or do they extend to possession?
They are only related to shooting. For example, Virginia is very clear. It says shooting guns. The New Jersey statute did temporarily dispossess intoxicated people. They weren't allowed to have the gun. But again, the purpose of that statute is different than what we're looking at today. The purpose of that statute was militia readiness.
So we're sort of struggling with what's an equivalency. It is the government's burden. They've got to come up with some similar historical tradition. And they're coming up with prohibitions on mentally ill and intoxicated. You're sort of accepting that intoxicated could apply, but you're saying the examples they've given really aren't as broad as 922 G3. Is that right?
Absolutely not. The government has failed to present a single instance in which somebody was permanently deprived of their Second Amendment right as a result of having a firearm or using a firearm. Not to mention the fact that, as applies to Mr. Daniels, there's no evidence at all that he was actively intoxicated at the time he was found to be in possession of the firearm.
I'm sure you know, this came up in a motion to dismiss, right?
It did, Your Honor.
In July of last year. And that hearing was very quick.
It was, Your Honor.
At most 10 minutes.
I think each side got 10 minutes, if I remember the record correctly.
No one presented experts. No one offered any historical evidence at all. How is that consistent with what the Supreme Court majority said has to be done, which is that the parties have to collect and test historical evidence?
Well, Your Honor, I think in this case, the procedural posture matters. Obviously, this case was tried shortly after Bruin was handed down, like maybe 10 days. And so it wasn't very clear to the trial court at that point. And if you look at the trial court's order, they rely heavily on Fifth Circuit precedent in this case that had previously dealt with Section
8. But I guess you can see the direction of my question. Why would anyone be asking us to do the historical inquiry? Isn't the Supreme Court saying that district judges who can call under 706 authority experts, they've at least got to do more than what was done in this case?
Your Honor, but it is a question of law, and so it doesn't necessarily require the district court.
Well, why do you say it is a question of law? I mean, and if you look at Bruin, the court refers to historical evidence over 30 times.
Mm-hmm. But the historical evidence is going to be largely statutory. And if you're interpreting the statute and looking at it as a historical analog, then that wouldn't necessarily require experts. There certainly may be some cases where an expert might be required to clarify the history. For example, if there are some traditions and customs that matter, but in this case—
This came up right after Bruin. Would you object to a remand for expert testimony?
Absolutely would object to that remand, Your Honor.
And what's your best authority that we don't have discretion to say that's the wisest thing to do? Because at this point, we've got district courts all over the place, correct?
Yes.
Connolly recently favors you. Castellanos, is that how you pronounce it? The Maryland case?
I believe so. It does not.
So district courts are reading the same history, and they come out with opposite conclusions, and you just want us to make an announcement?
Your Honor, I would argue that they're not looking at the history differently. If you look at the statutes underlying the court's analysis, it's largely the same body of historical law.
But they come to opposite conclusions about what historical truth is.
They do, Your Honor, because they are relying on what the circuit courts have done with respect to Second Amendment precedent. For the Connolly case is a perfect example of that, Your Honor. Judge Cardone took a look at it before Rahimi and was looking at it in the context of Patterson and May, which are all pre-Bruin cases, and said, the Fifth Circuit tells me that I can't, but I have serious reservations about making this woman a felon and holding her criminally liable and stripping her of her Second Amendment rights for a substance that is largely not considered criminal anymore. Then Rahimi came down, and on a motion to reconsider, Judge Cardone looked at it again, and she said, well, under Rahimi, Rahimi tells me that this is how I need to look at the Second Amendment. This is how I need to look at the law. And the difference is the same.
You said a substance that's generally not considered criminal anymore? Have you read the state laws of Texas, Louisiana, and Mississippi?
I've taken a quick look at those, Your Honor. Texas does allow low CBD for medical marijuana purposes. Louisiana has had medical...
So what? That's not what was involved here.
It was marijuana.
Don't spend our time arguing that Texas, Louisiana, and Mississippi don't prohibit possession and use of marijuana, because you know that's not true. You got to have stronger arguments than that.
I do, Your Honor. But the fact of the matter is that this is not a substance. It's quite akin to alcohol with effect to the intoxication. And so the historical arguments there tell us that, again, the answer is not, and the answer never has been, to permanently strip someone of their Second Amendment rights.
Well, this is... Your client's not being permanently stripped, right? In other words, if your client were no longer using marijuana, then it wouldn't apply. Sometime in the future, I'm talking about, not this prosecution, but sometime in the future.
He has been effectively stripped. This conviction makes him a felon, which under 922 G1 permanently prohibits him from ever having or using a firearm. And so it's not the harmless statute that the government has made it out to be, where if, you know, Mr. Daniels had just stopped smoking marijuana for some unknown period of time, then he would have had his Second Amendment's rights reinstated. It simply doesn't work that way. Now, if he had, as the historical statutes allowed, been fined or served a misdemeanor sentence, then we wouldn't be here today.
Do any of our three states prohibit unlawful users of drugs from possessing guns?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. I'm happy to supplement if you'd
like. What is the district court tally as to G3 right now, to your knowledge?
I have counted just over a dozen. In the Fifth Circuit, we have Black and Sanchez and then Connolly. Black and Sanchez were decided before Rahimi.
Post-Rahimi, post-Bruin cases, how divided are the district courts around the country to your tally?
So I believe that most of them would favor the government, but for reasons I think that are different than the historical analysis. Again, I think the historical analysis has largely been the same, but if you look at the Seventh Circuit and the Eighth Circuit, they are saying that their precedent prohibits them from going back and revisiting this question, that it has been held to be constitutional, whereas in Rahimi, this court has said we have to start over. We have to look at this with new eyes in light of Bruin.
But Rahimi, you're relying on strongly, and you're right. It is binding to us. But Rahimi, the individual wasn't even charged, right? G3 requires that it be unlawful use. So that is a little different. It makes it more like G1.
I disagree, no? Your Honor. Okay. There is no triggering event in G3. Like in G8 with Rahimi, there was a triggering event. It was a civil proceeding, and the panel said that's insufficient.
But a jury's got to find beyond a reasonable doubt it was unlawful use here. That sounds to me like a criminal.
But yeah? Those are two different analyses, I think, Your Honor.
Okay.
The first one, the one that you're referring to, is that he is prohibited from using a firearm as long as he is an unlawful user. And we can get into the vagueness argument on that if you would like, because in this case, this should be treated, the statute needs to be more specific. It needs to be treated akin to a First Amendment statute. Mr. Daniels would have no idea how long he would need to stop using marijuana. And it doesn't just cover illegal substances either. This applies to all controlled substances under the Controlled Substances Act, which would regulate heartburn medication, blood pressure medication, pain medication, mental health medications, all of those things are covered under this statute. And it's just not clear what Mr. Daniels would have needed to do or not do to even avoid being charged with this statute.
Are we, as an appellate court, are we bound strictly to the historical evidence presented to the district court? Can we embark on our own excavation or research, or are we bound only by those colonial era analogs and other evidence presented to the district court?
Your Honor, it would be limited to what the mm-hmm. government has presented, because it is their burden.
Right, and if we find that, it's a close call, ambiguous, say we find it's ambiguous, who wins?
The history?
Mm-hmm.
I think the tie goes to Mr. Daniels in that instance, because it is a fundamental constitutional right.
And the government bears the burden.
And the government bears the burden. And again,
Following up on that question, what if the government points to Reconstruction era laws? Would you say that's not permissible? Do we have any post-Bruin guidance as to that when it's a federal statute? Do you think we have to look at the founding era only?
I would say that's a question for you, ultimately, obviously.
Well, what are other courts? I mean, we've got a wildfire of Bruin cases. Are most courts... Are most courts that are looking at the validity of 922G status prohibitions limiting the government to colonial era analogs?
They definitely give heavier weight to the colonial era analogs, especially in light of this being a federal statute. In this case, the Reconstruction era statutes, they tell you the same thing. In this case, it doesn't matter, Your Honor. So you could reserve the answer to that question for another day. And it may very well be that there are some Reconstruction era statutes that matter in one case, depending on where that statute was drafted.
Under what logic would we be able to uphold the constitutionality of a federal statute by looking at something a century after the founding era?
And again, I think it depends on the case. Obviously, this is a straightforward case. This problem has persisted since before the founding era. And this is how our founding fathers dealt with it. In state statutes, it was temporary limitation on the use of firearms for intoxicated people. And so I don't know that a sweeping decision on how to look at these Second Amendment cases is absolutely necessary in this case. And this statute is a straightforward case. It can be fairly easily disposed of. Mr. Daniels' conviction can be vacated, and then
Would your logic compel striking down almost all red flag laws? Basically, you're saying there isn't a tradition of stripping people who are dangerous to themselves or to others of their right to possess guns. Is that essentially?
I think Rahimi answers that question in part, Your Honor. It's clear that Mr. Rahimi was at least of risk to one person, and this court found that that wasn't sufficient to compel a permanent restriction on Second Amendment rights. And I see I have about 2 minutes left. I'm happy to continue.
Keep going.
The historical analogs are very clear. The New Jersey statute, which allowed officers to disarm intoxicated soldiers during the militia training only, didn't just apply to intoxicated soldiers. The entire statute talks about the ability to disarm soldiers who use abusive language, soldiers who quarrel with other soldiers. So again, military readiness was the key. And then again, with the New York statute, that statute existed for about 2 years in the late 1700s. It prevented anyone from shooting guns for a three-day period over New Year's to avoid what the statute calls great damage. Now, it's not clear whether that's to property or to people, but that applied to everybody. And again, it was a temporary restriction. The problem with Section 922 G3 is that it imposes a permanent ban. If someone is convicted under the statute, they are a felon. Mr. Daniels is currently serving 46 months in a federal facility for having less than half a gram of marijuana and two firearms that otherwise would have been legal. The historical tradition simply doesn't support that kind of permanent and total restriction on his Second Amendment rights. And again, the temporary ban that the government will refer to, it's not clear. There's no consensus on what constitutes an unlawful user. And the statutes, the cases that have addressed this statute have been all over the place. They use clarifying language that is not clarifying. They use different time periods. There's a federal regulation that would impose a ban for up to a year. And that doesn't even bring into account the question of, does intent matter? If the law enforcement officer had
pulled... You're saying the district courts that have ruled opposite to you have just not done any thorough historical inquiry?
They haven't.
So why are you opposing a remand so it can be done thoroughly?
Oh, Your Honor, I apologize. I was talking about the vagueness argument. They haven't done a deep dive.
Well, that was your, but it was your reply brief argument also that they just haven't done the historical inquiry. The ones that have affirmed haven't done it correctly to show a tradition.
Correctly. And in part, and I see my time is up, but in part that is because Rahimi, for our circuit, has just recently come out and has set the standard for that. But again, the historical statutes are there, they're clear, they're the same ones that are being relied on across the country. And so it's really just a matter of how the court deals with the legal analysis. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Ms. Gore. You save some time for rebuttal. Mr. Buckner.
May it please the court. I'm Jonathan Buckner, and I, along with my colleague Gaines Cleveland, represent the government in this case. Section 922 G3 temporarily prohibits an individual who chooses to be an active and unlawful user of a controlled substance from possessing a firearm. And Section 922 G3 is constitutional because that temporary prohibition regulates an individual and an individual whose conduct takes him outside the scope of the Second Amendment, and because that regulation is consistent with this nation's longstanding history and tradition of firearms regulation.
So speaking of the conduct, what does the federal criminal code say right now about possession and use of marijuana?
The possession of marijuana is a misdemeanor offense. First conviction, a misdemeanor offense. After one conviction, for simple possession of marijuana, you actually are subjected to potential penalties more akin to a felony offense, up to a year in prison, Your Honor.
And what does Mississippi law say?
Mississippi law is that you can't recreationally use marijuana. At the time of this offense,
You cannot recreationally
use marijuana. And at the time of this offense, you couldn't use it medicinally either. There's been a change recently where you could use it medicinally. But there's no proof in this case that Mr. Daniels was using it medicinally. He was a recreational user, and that's unlawful under Mississippi law and under federal law.
So Ms. Gore was inaccurate when she said that a use of marijuana, to use her words, is not generally considered criminal.
No, in fact, in most states, recreational use of marijuana is still illegal. The majority of states still ban the recreational use of marijuana. So that's
correct. I guess I'd love to know the government's sort of threshold position and how much you think we're bound by Rahimi. In other words, do you agree that you are at the step two place?
No, Your Honor. I think this case can be distinguished from Rahimi, particularly in light of Rahimi's the revised opinion, where the court indicated, look, when we look at the law-abiding, responsible citizen analog, the real question we're asking, is this the type of person who the founders would have presumptively tolerated being disarmed or would have tolerated being disarmed? And one thing, when you look at Rahimi as well, you look at Judge Ho's concurring opinion, where he talks about, look, in this case, there's not been any finding that Rahimi engaged in other criminal conduct. It was a civil domestic violence restraining order. Whereas in this case, the jury found beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. Daniels had engaged in other unlawful conduct. They found that. So it squarely takes it outside of the realm of law-abiding, responsible citizens.
So the government is still, in spite of Rahimi, you still think that the Second Amendment only applies to law-abiding Americans?
I think that when the jury makes a finding that that individual is not law-abiding, that takes it to the point of the revised Rahimi opinion, where the founders would have found that disarming that person, they would have presumptively tolerated it, or tolerated it. And that's what the Rahimi revised opinion said. It kind of went back a little bit, clawed back a little bit from the original opinion and said, look, there are some people like felons and mentally ill that the founders presumptively would have tolerated. That's the way that we read the revised opinion in Rahimi. And I do think it can be distinguished from this case because the jury made that finding. They made the explicit finding that he was an unlawful user of a controlled substance. And so in some ways, 922G3 is even more...
But all our case law in this area relating to 922G and all its subcomponents, for example, especially Patterson, the means end scrutiny, that's all been repudiated. You can't rely on Patterson or Emerson. Is that correct?
Rahimi abrogated Emerson, and Patterson does cite Emerson.
Okay, that's what I thought. I agree with that.
So
if my brain is thinking you're at step two, of course you do think you've identified a historical tradition.
That's correct.
What is the single colonial era gun stripping that you would point to as the clearest analog? Just one, the strongest example in the colonial era.
It would be the way that the colonial era dealt with those who are mentally ill. Because they could be locked up.
So just give me the exact law in the colonial era that said mentally ill people are dispossessed of guns.
It's not that they were dispossessed of guns, Your Honor. It was more of the practice and practice of locking those up who were mentally ill, and then they'd be dispossessed.
Okay, I'm just to test you. I'm saying this is sounding weak.
Well,
if I ask you what is the closest colonial era analog, and you're saying, well, it relates to mentally ill, but you haven't told me the particular law that was upheld, and it doesn't relate to just possession generally. You're relying more on mentally ill prohibitions than you are on intoxication prohibitions?
And Your Honor asked for one specific.
Yeah, I want your best. I always ask that. What is your best single example?
Right, and I think that because a person who unlawfully uses controlled substances does place themselves in a position where their mind is altered, akin to those who are mentally ill. That's one of the reasons. And the Supreme Court has already said prohibitions on those who are mentally ill are valid. Basically,
that's a Heller carve-out, right?
Right, and the court in Bruin and the concurrence, they also say that.
But so, you're not saying this case is controlled by one of the Heller carve-outs, are you? Or you are?
I think that the Supreme Court, I'm taking the Supreme Court for what they've said.
Okay, what I'm really just asking you for is just point me to a specific colonial era law.
Yes, Your Honor. In addition to...
Tell me the colony and tell me the law.
There's the New York statute that prohibited those who were using firearms during New Year's, and the reason that they couldn't was because of the great damage that were done based on liquor.
I'm not trying to be difficult, but that's not mentally ill, right? Well, that's the intoxication case.
That's correct, Your Honor. And if I may, part of the issue is that controlled substances weren't an issue until the late 1800s and 1900s, controlled substances other than alcohol. And so you don't have that dead ringer statutory analog from the past. Because what we have here...
Just asking for the similar. And you're, so instead of a prohibition on mentally ill, you're saying it's the New Year's Eve, can't shoot guns on New Year's Eve. That's supposed to be the equivalency?
No, sir. I think you have to look at it all in combination and remember the fact that at that time, drinking was not illegal. Drinking wasn't... And that's one thing that some of the courts, the two courts that have looked at this issue and said 922G3 falls, is they say, well, these intoxication statutes require you to be intoxicated at the time. But what the government's position is, look, this is not, it's not the same thing as alcohol, because drugs are illegal to possess and illegal to use, period. And they weren't an issue until the late 1800s, early 1900s, and that's when you start to see the historical prohibition on actual unlawful users. And so while the Gun Control Act wasn't enacted until 1968...
Okay, so the argument you're making isn't a colonial era one, because you're saying illegal narcotics, controlled substance, didn't even appear until later.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so we're not looking at the colonial era statutes.
I think the court should still look to those, but you don't have to find one that's distinctly similar. You can find one that's relevantly similar. And so our position is that when you look at the intoxication statutes, you look at the going arm laws, you look at the prohibitions on those who are mentally ill, including the fact that they could be locked up and dispossess the firearms in that way, what you have are similar analogs to what we have today. And then once controlled substances became an issue, other than alcohol, once we have illegal narcotics becoming an issue, you actually start to see state legislatures banning the use, those who unlawfully use controlled substances from possessing firearms. So you have to look at it in total, and you don't have to find one that's distinctly similar. And I think that's the issue that I was trying to address earlier, is that there isn't a distinctly similar analog to...
If we can look, and I don't mean to dominate, so colleagues will jump in, but if we can look to that later era, what is the single clearest state example banning possession as to persons who are unlawfully using drugs?
In Mississippi, I believe in 1938, there was a ban on the possession of firearms by those who were unlawful drug users. So
that's in your brief.
Yes, Your Honor, I believe so. And I could be wrong on the date of the law on that, yeah. But it was a Mississippi statute. And there's some other similarities too. We talk about those who are mentally ill and those who are intoxicated in our brief, but we also talk about those that the legislatures believe are dangerous to the community. And the Supreme Court even cites D.E. Sickles' order during the Reconstruction period, where he said that those who are vagrants and disturbers of the peace can't possess firearms. That was in Bruin. And so that's an example of
That's a Union general.
That's correct.
Occupying the South, saying vagrants can't get guns.
That's correct.
It seems very different than what Congress has passed here.
But it's
a military decree.
That's correct. But you also have the Ohio statute that bans tramps from possessing firearms as well. And that was actually found constitutional. So what this shows is this historical trend of dispossessing those who are believed to be dangerous by legislatures or those enacting regulations because of the danger they pose to others. And that's what 922G3 does. It's also a difference between 922G3 and the Rahimi case. What the court said in Rahimi was that individual posed a danger to one person, not the general.
It's a historical trend allowing legislatures to dispossess Americans of their right to possess guns if they think they're dangerous. Is that correct?
That's what they've done throughout history. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, and so do we need to find any source that links? So mentally ill people tend to be victims much more than perpetrators. Do we need to have any verifying linkage that this category of people that a legislature says could never have a gun again has to actually be dangerous, or is it just they think they're dangerous?
I believe that if the congressional record supports that finding that they're dangerous, these statutes have been upheld in the past.
I thought the theory would be that they're dangerous because they're impaired. They may be impaired because they're mentally impaired in some way, or because they're using a drug that that affects one's judgment, or because they're using alcoholic beverages in a way that impairs their judgment, whether it's driving a car or operating equipment or anything else.
That's correct, Your Honor, and that is one of the reasons that Congress enacted this legislation, is because they found that the possession of firearms by those who have had their mind altered by the use of controlled substances does pose a danger to the community. So again,
do we need record evidence of the sort of impairing effect of marijuana? Do we take judicial notice of that? Do we need record evidence of that?
Bruin and Heller don't require that. I don't think the court needs record evidence of that. And I don't think that Daniels can reasonably say that it's not dangerous for someone who is an unlawful user of marijuana to possess a firearm. Particularly when you look at the firearms at issue here, you have an assault-style rifle loaded with a 22-round clip that was fully loaded as well. And you've got a semi-automatic handgun too. So I don't think
About her argument that it's not just marijuana, it could be nicotine, it's any controlled substance. She listed a few.
One, that's not what the charge here is, right? And two, I think that's I'm not aware of anyone nationwide being charged with being an unlawful user of nicotine in possession of a firearm, Your Honor. So I don't know that would be the case with respect to how 922G3 would be applied nationally, and it's definitely not the case as applied to Mr.
What is the tally out right now? Do you agree with her?
I think it's 15-2 nationwide in favor of the government. And again, I think that you look at the Connolly case where originally it went
to go. No other circuit court.
No circuit court. There was a summary of affirmance by the Second Circuit, but it didn't really address the meat and potatoes of the 922G3.
Go ahead with Connolly. How would you?
Well, that's 15-2 post Bruin, post Rahimi.
That's post Bruin, not post Rahimi. I haven't separated it out post Rahimi, and a lot of those cases come from other circuits as well. But what the court in Connolly did. Originally, they went the government's way. Then after Rahimi, the judge reconsidered and found that it was unconstitutional. And they looked to the intoxication statutes and they said, look, this requires someone to be intoxicated at the time they possess the firearm. 922G3 is broader than that. It's unconstitutional. Again, I think that the court was looking for a distinctly similar or dead ringer regulation. And because of how our history has been shaped with controlled substance uses, you don't have to have that. And the court in Bruin was explicit that you don't. You don't need a dead ringer, and it's not some analogical straitjacket. So again, I think that if you actually look at the scope of firearms regulation over time, you get to the proper result, which is that this is consistent with this nation's longstanding history of firearm regulation. One other thing that I would like to discuss is the thought that this is some permanent ban on someone's possession of a firearm. 922G3 is not a permanent ban. That permanent ban comes by way of 922G1, the felon in possession charge, which is not before the court today. And if you take that train of thought to the end, logically, that would make any federal felony susceptible to a Second Amendment charge, because that permanently bans someone of their right to possess a firearm. So I think we have to be really careful about what statute the court is reviewing today.
But Ms. Gorey is correct that that's the practical consequence as to her client.
It is, but that's the same consequence with respect to any felony conviction. So I think that if the issue before the court today is 922G3, it's not 922G1. And 922G3 is a temporary ban. And it's evidenced by the jury instructions that Judge Girola gave the jury in this case, in which he told them that in order to return a conviction, they had to find that he was an active user, that Daniels was an active user of a controlled substance at the time that he possessed the firearm. So again, if someone is no longer an active user, if they choose to stop doing what they're doing unlawfully, they can possess their firearms again.
As the First Circuit that's going to be deciding a very important federal criminal statute, do you still agree with opposing counsel that we shouldn't remand when the motion to dismiss, really my count, is 10 pages long? Both sides gave virtually no analogs. Why would a court of review not a court of original jurisdiction that could call in the Duke Center on Firearms Law and really solve this so we're not just all guessing about what history is?
I don't think that there's a dispute as to what the actual history is. And so really it's more of a question as to whether or not the analogical reasoning that this court needs to make with respect to that history goes in favor of the government or goes in favor
of
the
people. People keep unearthing different points in history, military decrees, colonial era. And you know, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm sure you know Bruin well, but in footnote 6, Justice Thomas says the dissent is wrong that this is unworkable. Why? Because parties can collect evidence, evidence can be tested, and he cites an article about originalism that talks about how lawyers in trial courts determine rights to riparian titles. None of that's been done here.
I understand the court's point on that, but the government's position, and it's the same position that we had in the Quiroz case.
You read that. Yes, you heard my frustration there too.
Yes, Your Honor, and I read the supplemental brief submitted by the
court. I'm just baffled the government wouldn't want to sort of prove its history and tradition rather than have piecemeal district courts all around the country saying history's one thing or the other. But you're here saying, as in Quiroz, no need to really get more any PhDs.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Why?
Because if you look at the history being cited by the courts across the country on this issue, the history is the same. Where the difference is how the judges make the analogy to 922G3 and whether
what's
they're
equivalent, what's not.
Right, and whether they're requiring a distinctly similar analog or a relevantly similar analog. And in this case, we believe that all that's required is a relevantly similar analog. And if you look at that, if you look at it in toto, all from the founding, actually from pre-founding to now, there's been this tradition of disarming people like Mr. Daniels who pose a danger to the community. And then finally, with respect to the vagueness issue, Mr. Daniels can't claim that this statute was unconstitutionally vague or that his conduct was not prescribed by the statute. There's one issue in the brief, in Daniels' brief, he says, well, I stopped smoking weeks ago, but the record doesn't actually support that. There's nothing in the record that shows he stopped smoking weeks before his last traffic stop. In fact, the month before his traffic stop, he was stopped with firearms and multiple bags of marijuana.
When we're marching through step two of Bruin, who decides questions of historical fact? Legal historians, law professors, do we take judicial notice of historical evidence? I mean,
the court on review, the Supreme Court in Bruin,
right,
made those determinations as to here's the fact and here's the analogical tie between the shall issue regimes and the may issue regimes, licensing regimes at issue in that case. And I will point out that in approving the shall issue regimes, the court in Bruin implicitly approved Mississippi's shall issue regime, which limited those who illegally use controlled substances.
But you would agree with opposing counsel that if we find the historical evidence is ambiguous, the government loses?
I believe it's the government's burden, so if we don't meet that burden, we do lose, Your Honor. May I address that vagueness issue? One last point from the record, Your Honor.
I believe your time has expired.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Jeff.
Buckner. Ms. Gore, you've saved some time for rebuttal.
May it please the court. Thank you, Your Honors. First, I'd like to clear up a concern that Judge Smith had. Yes, under federal law, marijuana is technically a criminalized substance, but there are 21 states who have legalized recreational use, 37 states, including all of the states in the circuit, that have legalized some sort of medical marijuana use.
Well, are you aware of what happened in the last session of the Texas legislature that adjourned last Monday? There were substantial efforts to, this is my word, liberalized possession and use of marijuana, and those efforts all failed, and the legislature doesn't meet again in regular session for two more years. So that if that says anything about the trend in Texas, it cuts against you. In any event, whether it's legal in Colorado, which I guess was maybe the first state to step out and make the changes several years ago, it's illegal in all 50 states and the District of Columbia under federal law. I'm sure you acknowledge that. There's no reason to to spend your valuable time trying to argue otherwise, because we know what the law is on that.
But Judge Wyrick, I think, took careful consideration of this in the Harrison decision. And what he said is, yes, I'm acknowledging that there is a disconnect between federal law and state law. But the fact is, the Second Amendment is a fundamental right. And to dispossess people who are using a substance that is legal in some instances and not legal in others is violative of the Constitution. The second point I wanted
to... legal in some instances and not in others. I don't know what you mean by that. You keep digging your hole deeper on this.
It's legal under state law, but it's illegal under federal law. And so that creates a problem for people who do use...
legal under state law where?
In 37 states, Your Honor.
Okay. In Texas, Louisiana, or Mississippi? No.
Not Texas allows for some CBD or THC usage, but it's very low dose. But medical marijuana exists in Louisiana and now in Mississippi.
But there's no claim of medical use here, even if it were lawful in Mississippi.
No, Your Honor, but we've raised a facial challenge. And so there are thousands of people.
You have a little time. You've been given a little guidance to get to any other points.
Yes, Your Honor. This is a permanent ban. After this conviction, Mr. Daniels will no longer be able to possess a firearm. And this is a Second Amendment-related statute. It's not the same as, you know, a felony for welfare fraud that puts somebody on that G1 list. This is a Second Amendment-related statute, and it requires the Bruin analysis. And the how and why that this statute burdens the Second Amendment right is simply inconsistent with any historical evidence that the government has presented. And the government agrees that the history is the same across all of these cases. There are very few colonial-era statutes that address this at all, and the reasons that they restrict firearm usage temporarily, I see my time is up, is
you,
not
necessarily... You can finish your sentence.
It's just not necessarily to address what the Gun Control Act was intended to address. And thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Gore. Your case is under submission. Next case, Terry versus Hooper.